gave up after 15 minutes, throwing pen and paper away, swept up in the inspiration of the hour. It was, he remembered, hard, heavy, knotty, gnarly, backed with wrath. Lincoln's gambit paid off. Within months, he became a champion of the new Republican Party. His golden opportunity soon followed in the senatorial election of 1858. He was pitted against Stephen Douglas, and the famous, worldly, and vain Douglas proved to be the perfect foil. Determined to make a national reputation for himself, Lincoln taunted and pressed and connived Douglas into a series of public debates, the sole topic of which would be slavery, from which Lincoln reasoned that he had nothing to lose and everything to gain. Douglas took the bait, with a Senate seat the ultimate prize. In the short term, it turned out, Lincoln was wrong. Not so in the long term. From August to October, the verbal jousting began. There were 7 encounters held from one end of the state to the other, and each was a grand event in itself, preceded and accompanied by bands and music and processions, with huge crowds numbering upward of 10,000. Over these 3 months, both drew blood and bled themselves, and in the end, Douglas won the seat in Washington. But Lincoln, once the darkest of dark horses, had won a prize he coveted equally, having now been transformed from a minor state politician into a budding national figure. It was heady stuff, and Lincoln didn't stop there. Denied the Senate, he brazenly sniffed a chance for no less than the presidency itself. He pounded away at the same theme over and over. If a halt was not put somewhere upon the spread of slavery, it would become nationwide, one universal slave nation, and then only the poor white men who would lose wages and jobs to slave workers would suffer. Yet even as he hammered away at his moral issue, Lincoln the moralist still wrestled with Lincoln the politician. In seeking to appeal to abolitionists and negrophobes at the same time, he was often caught in embarrassing contradictions. In Chicago, "Let us declare that all men are created equal." Then in Ottawa, "We cannot then make them, blacks, equals." But his ultimate goal was not intellectual consistency, but strategy. Namely, the challenge of how to meld old-line Whigs and anti-slavery men into one potent political party. By hammering home the issue of the alleged plan to extend slavery and the dangers that it would inflict upon the country, he was able to create a historically unique amalgam of political forces under the same tent. Abolitionists and negrophobes, high-tariff men and low-tariff men, former Whigs and embittered Democrats, immigrants and know-nothings, German tipplers and Maine law prohibitionists. It was nothing short of masterful, and this coalition would soon sweep him into power. But not yet. In the months that followed, Lincoln hit the lecture circuit. He gave speeches in half a dozen Midwestern states, and, for the first time, he spoke in New York, where he was a big success. His stinging message about slavery was now repeated by his political rivals as well as his allies. He pointed out again and again that if anything was wicked, slavery was wicked. The country had outlawed the exportation of slaves from America, and even Southerners did not dispute that. It had prohibited the importation of slaves from Africa, and neither did Southerners dispute that. He pointed out that in the South, it was not the slave who was treated as a social pariah. In fact, he was often regarded as a member of the family, but the slave dealer himself. So then, didn't the South, in its heart, know that slave dealing and thus slave holding were wrong? Why else did Southerners routinely manumit? "Why," asked Lincoln, "have so many slaves been set free except by the promptings of conscience?" And in reply he was told, "You are like Byron, awoke to find himself famous." And soon, Lincoln was back home in Springfield when a telegram arrived informing him that he had been nominated for president at the Republican National Convention in Chicago. to Lincoln, you are nominated. Then, on November 7, 1860, at 2 a.m., the Telegraph rapped out this startling news. Lincoln was now elected President of the United States, having defeated his main opponent, none other than the little Democrat, Stephen Douglas. But in a grim sign of what was to come, the vote carried with it an ominous message. The nation was woefully divided. The dynamic of the election itself was unlike that of any other ever held. Lincoln had managed to win the necessary electoral college, getting a handy 180 votes, and carrying all but one of the free states. But this was misleading. He won only because it was a four-way race, and the Southern vote was split among two other candidates who had denied Douglas the chance to run as the only true national candidate, an appeal that he had nonetheless tried to make. On the popular vote, it was truly a squeaker. Lincoln got only 39.9%. His opponents, when totaled up, had defeated him by 2,815,617 votes to 1,866,452. And more revealingly, in 10 of the Southern states, Lincoln did not receive a single vote. In fact, in these states, the Republicans did not even bother to field a ticket. In the remaining five slave states, mainly in the Upper South, he received a pitiful 4% of the popular vote. There was a price to pay for such a split election, and for the reputation Lincoln had built for himself in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Mass hysteria soon consumed the country. Everywhere, people crowded the streets of southern cities with talk that a Republican victory meant disunion. Despite Lincoln's best efforts at moderation, the South would read his election in no other way. "The very existence of such a party is an offense to the whole South," explained one Virginia legislative committee. A New Orleans newspaper was just as blunt. Every Northern vote cast for Lincoln was a deliberate, cold-blooded insult and outrage to the South. Nor were they alone in their apocalyptic alarms. There were considerable doubters in the North as well. "Free love and free niggers will certainly elect old Abe," warned one Democratic banner in New York. And if it was clear that Lincoln had succeeded in terrifying the South, it was less clear that he had succeeded in convincing the rest of the country of his positions. Early in 1861, the Republicans in Congress gave their votes to measures organizing the territories in Colorado, Nevada, and Dakota without prohibiting slavery. Douglas's proposed policy, not Abe Lincoln's. Now the great question would be, was Lincoln equal to the task? Was he equal to the approaching Civil War? Or for that matter, it could well be asked, was he even ready for the presidency? Many thought not. He was widely dismissed as a guerrilla, regarded as a third-rate lawyer, considered a nullity, and mocked as a duffer, a rough farmer, and a man in the habit of making coarse and clumsy jokes. Members of his own cabinet derided him behind his back. Stanton called him the original baboon, a western hick, and that giraffe. His first attorney general said he was unexceptional. Simon Cameron, his treasury secretary, was openly discourteous to him. Lincoln's way of speaking alone made him suspect. He said, "kin" for "can," "sot" for "set," "earth" for "earth," "heerd" for "heard," and "Mr. Chairman" for "Mr. Chairman." His high-pitched twang was an oddity in the genteel salons and artful councils of official Washington. The real Lincoln, a curious amalgam of candor and obfuscation, country boy and learned lawyer, was, and would remain, alien to the city's elite. Yet here he was. And there remains a larger issue. History should not mask or obscure just how ill-prepared Lincoln really was for the job. Before his stunning victory, consider his resume. He himself wrote his own campaign autobiography, all 800 words of it, in December 1859. I was losing interest in politics when the repeal of the Missouri Compromise aroused me again, he cleverly wrote. What I have done since then is pretty well known. In fact, what was well known was not very much. He was a formerly obscure legislator, an equally obscure one-term congressman, and in his first foray into big-time politics, he was a failure in his bid for the U.S. Senate. He was a good party man, first as a Whig and then as a Republican. He was an eloquent orator, had a subtle mind, and his droll ways and dry jokes made him formidable on the stump. He made many speeches and many fine ones. But had he not been elected president, everything about his career thus far would smack of the persistent efforts of a political junkie and an average political hack, a hanger-oner, a man who doesn't know when to quit. Put aside the fact that he had not a single shred of executive experience, he had barely employed a single person in his life, nor had he ever served in actual combat. Unlike a George Washington or an Andrew Jackson, he had not commanded an army to mighty victories. His sole military experience consisted of a paltry 80 days in the Black Hawk War. After he was elected captain of his volunteer company, the first time he ever gave an order, the soldier snapped back, "Go to hell." Moreover, foreshadowing later difficulties with AIDS, he failed to maintain even the minimum discipline among his men, and was subsequently punished by his ranking officers, who ordered him to carry a wooden sword for 2 days. Nor was Lincoln cosmopolitan, or worldly, or schooled in the diplomatic arts. Unlike a Thomas Jefferson, he had not lived abroad, or even been abroad, let alone served as a minister to a foreign country like France. Nor could he claim the benefit of a powerful and thoughtful mentor who had shown him the ropes, or the experience of having apprenticed as Secretary of State or Vice President, as was the case with a number of his more distinguished predecessors. And there was an even more troubling question, the simmering matter of his temperament, the fact that he was a man so prone to depressions and a fathomless gloom that he once mourned, "I laugh because I cannot weep." Throughout his life, he had found solace in the incessant activity of politics, but in his depressed moods, we can see him uneasily treading his way through time, hoping for a reprieve. Was this the man to guide the country through its greatest crisis? Where, in those darkest moments, would his inner resolve come from? And, as for his election, this in itself said very little, nor was it a guide to how he would perform. Despite calculations by Lincolnographers or post-election calculations by statisticians, his victory was in many ways a fluke and nothing more. And while he had a keen and subtle mind, and is judged by history to have bested Douglas in their debates, he was hardly the first brilliant man to occupy the presidency. Although, as every historian well knows, in the end, it is not brilliance but judgment that separates the great leaders from the routine. As for the passion he brought to the slavery issue, he regarded the institution as ugly and sinister, but even here, his passion was tempered by his innate caution, as well as by his reluctance to get too far ahead of public opinion on this matter. But then, the war entered his life. He wanted this war the way a felon wants a hangman's noose. Now he was no longer waiting in the wings to stride out onto the stage of history. It had mercilessly arrived at his doorstep, and would provide him with on-the-job training. Like it or not, for this lifelong, risk-averse politician, there was no escaping the mayhem to come. Nothing, then, about his background recommended Lincoln to the daunting task he was about to face. The great question now confronting him, and the country, was ultimately no longer slavery per se, or freedom in the territories, but the very nation itself. And in answering this, Lincoln turned out to be second to none. Reaching deep down into the wellspring of his soul, no man was more fervent in his belief in the Union. No man loved his country, North as well as South, as much as Lincoln. And no man was more concerned about not simply winning the war, but about keeping the country and the nation together. Ultimately, it was this belief that would give him the inner strength to go on. In the sobering days and months and years ahead, he would need it. Somehow, at the hour of fate and the crack of doom, he would find himself. As the war ground on, it would become a duel over the soul of America. But not at first, not as Lincoln prowled back and forth in his office, head down, hands clasped behind his back, asking, "What now?" What now indeed? From the start, Lincoln's program was quite clear. His goal was not revolution, nor was it to destroy the South's social fabric, nor did he want war. He wanted union. And he accepted war only when it seemed necessary to keep union. Everything was subordinate to his mystical attachment to union, including slavery. In fact, when Congress passed a constitutional amendment, the first and ultimately unratified 13th Amendment, guaranteeing that the federal government would never interfere with slavery, and thus affixing the right of bondage firmly in the constitutional structure of the country, Lincoln supported it. "I have no objection to its being made express and irrevocable." This sentiment would be repeated most poignantly, and for many quite tragically, when he wrote a reply to Horace Greeley, who had just published a ferocious editorial, The Prayer of 20 Millions, that accused Lincoln of being strangely and disastrously remiss in not emancipating the slaves. Lincoln ripped back immediately, by letter, for all to see. "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and it is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some slaves and leaving others alone, I would do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save the Union." This, then, was the Lincoln program. Save the Union, bring the South back, restore orderly government, establish the principle that force cannot win out, and, he hoped, do it with the least cost of lives. But did he fully comprehend what war meant? Like just about everyone else, North or South, it is unlikely. He certainly did not expect a long fight. His first call was for a paltry 75,000 volunteers, requiring only a 3 months enlistment. These were not the preparations for war, but for a fleeting skirmish. Lincoln had his blind spots. His first was misjudging the mood and the commitment of the South. His second was not initially understanding the dynamics of war that raise passions and harden sides. However, as the war dragged on and the body count mounted, it became clear that the sacred struggle would be neither brief nor easy, nor, for that matter, necessarily victorious. And herein, too, lay his recalcitrance toward emancipation. Political and strategic considerations had, of necessity, to trump moral considerations. All else was, by definition, secondary. To end slavery, he would have to preserve the Union. To preserve the Union, he would have to win the war. And to win the war, he would have to hold his fragile coalition together. He had 4 border states, Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri, and Delaware, all of them slave-owning, with roughly 500,000 slaves among them, which were crucial to the war effort. 3 of these states, as a simple glance at the map revealed, were vital not only to Union strategy, but to the safety of the northern capital itself. None would take part in an anti-slavery campaign. Nor, for that matter, would a majority of the northern people. While a noisy minority of radicals insisted that he liberate the slaves, clamoring that it was self-contradictory to fight the war without smashing slavery, Lincoln knew that a far greater section of northern opinion was willing to fight for the Union, but not for a crusade of emancipation. In time, as the conflict dragged on, as is always the case, war began to change things, and it would change Lincoln. But Lincoln resisted the forces of social revolution swarming around him. Indeed, he resisted the very fate that would make him a living icon of freedom. All was contingent, he believed, upon the survival of the Union, which meant, of course, the success of the force of arms. Here, Lincoln also made his share of mistakes, and history should not obscure his patchy record, erased only by adoring hindsight and the brilliant final months of the war. Day in and day out, as he hauled his tired bones to the War Department to read the latest dispatches, as he mulled over his ocean of troubles, his inexperience came back to haunt him. In those early years, he was anything but the picture of the confident, or seasoned, or well-oiled commander-in-chief. To be sure, he had his work cut out for him. He had generals who wouldn't fight, couldn't fight, failed to press on for the advantage when they did fight, or simply got whipped. What to do? Lincoln's initial response was almost predictable. He checked out books from the Library of Congress on the science and strategy of war and put himself through a rigid crash course on how to command an army. The results of his efforts were less than heartening. A case in point. One evening, Lincoln and his Secretary of State called upon General-in-Chief George McClellan at his house. McClellan flatly refused to see them, strolling past the very room where the President sat and going upstairs to bed. Not anticipating such an insult, Lincoln sat there, in the parlor, for more than an hour. Unthinkable as this was, Lincoln never reprimanded McClellan. And this one incident belies a far deeper irony. We think of Lincoln as a consummate statesman, a humanitarian, a cosmic thinker, all of which is true. But he was unable to inspire or lead some of his own subordinates. He did not routinely dwarf his own aides or generals, as strong presidents must, nor was he invariably feared by his political adversaries and rivals. Too often, they felt that they could defy him. At times, he seemed downright paralyzed. Later, in 1862, when McClellan simply refused to attack the Confederates, Lincoln's response was nothing short of pathetic. While members of the Hill, led by Benjamin Wade, clamored for McClellan's head, Lincoln asked feebly, "If I remove McClellan, whom shall I put in command?" "Well, anybody," Wade said. "Well, anybody will do for you," Lincoln said, "but not for me. I must have somebody." But he stuck with McClellan, even as his own cabinet called McClellan's actions imbecilic, even as he was lectured to command the commanders, even as his own wife, Mary, sized McClellan up far better than he did. "He's a humbug," Mary frowned sourly. "But why?" Lincoln asked, almost naively. "Because he talks so much and does so little." These were clearly the actions of a still tentative man, and a man who was not always a confident judge of people. Only after much wasted time was McClellan finally dismissed. And he was just one of a procession of generals who, in one shape or another, proved woefully unsatisfactory. There were William Rosencrantz, Ambrose Burnside, John Pope, and Joseph Hooker. Lincoln fired Burnside and replaced him with Hooker after Hooker had already called the president a played-out imbecile. And there was George Meade. But with brooding detachment, Lincoln pressed on, weathering his own mistakes and equally weathering the brittle highs and soaring lows of the war. If he can best be described during this period, it is with two words, dogged tenacity. Dogged tenacity. It is a simple explanation for greatness, but in Lincoln's case, also probably quite true. For one thing, he needed it. One of the great historical questions is, why didn't Lincoln give up or give in? Why, when the opportunity for ending the killing presented itself, did he not grab the easy way out, or the expedient way, as he had so often in the past? Lincoln would hardly have been the first head of state to bend to the rancorous demands of nationalism being pressed upon him in a long and difficult civil war. Had he done so, history might well have deemed it a necessary matter, or even praised him for wisely not subjecting the North to a continuing tornado of blood and wreckage, or for having rescued his shattered, broken country from America's 19th century version, as it were, of Vietnam. he might have been recorded in history books as the man who saved, protected, and preserved the free Union. And in any case, he would have been but one member of a long line of kings and monarchs and emperors and other chiefs of state who bowed or compromised to the powerful tide of history, to the irrepressible forces of self-determination and nationalism that were then sweeping the globe and would continue to do so for the next nearly 150 years. Far from being condemned, many of these leaders have been roundly praised. Consider how tempting it might have been to any other president. At several points during the war, it looked as though the Confederacy could, or even would, win, or at least wouldn't lose, which amounted to much the same thing. Other times, after he finally appointed U.S. Grant, "At last," Lincoln cried out joyously, "a general who fights." It was unclear whether the public would persevere with him. The four-day New York riots of 1863, which left at least 105 dead, the worst ever in American history, then or now, was one grim reminder. The city was beset by such turmoil that the New York Times and Park Row had 3 Gatling guns mounted on the roof and in the windows for protection. The storm of protests throughout the Midwest to stop the war was another. The election he feared he would lose to McClellan in 1864 was still another. As the appalling Union casualties rose still further, the North was indeed in a foul mood. It literally began crying out for peace. One more season of slaughter would likely have been too much. In fact, in 4 years of war, an estimated 200,000 men deserted from the Federal Army. Everywhere Lincoln turned, there were fervent anti-war rallies. As the ever-erratic Horace Greeley wrote in 1864, "Our bleeding, bankrupt, almost dying country longs for peace." And this was not simply the anxious prattle of copperheads and a few highly visible editors and intellectuals. By now, battalions of peace movements had cropped up across the North and became the basis for the Democratic Party platform of 1864. After 4 years of failure to restore the Union by the experiment of war, we demand immediate efforts for a cessation of hostilities. And for Lincoln himself, the toll on his own psyche, of course, was brutal. During the Battle of the Wilderness, Lincoln scarcely slept for 4 days. As we are reminded in historian Stephen Oates' vivid description, he morosely paced in the War Department, he aimlessly roamed in his office, he wandered about in the White House corridors. "I must have some relief from this terrible anxiety," he moaned, "or it will kill me." And if that didn't kill him, the ongoing avalanche of abuse and criticism might. "There is a cowardly imbecile at the head of the government," warned one newspaper. "I am heartsick," cried one member of Congress, "at the mismanagement of the army." And, "Disgust with our government is universal," said another critic. Instead of glory, Lincoln once confessed, he found only ashes and blood. It is little wonder that the whole experience of the presidency was barren for him. Carl Sandburg would remark that there were 31 rooms in the White House, and Lincoln was not at home in any of them. But even as a deathly weariness settled over him, Lincoln was never mawkishly self-pitying. He did persevere. Consider his dispatches to his generals. "Hold on with a bulldog grip and chew and choke as much as possible. Stand firm. Hold firm, as with a chain of steel. Watch it every day, and hour, and force it. Once more, dogged tenacity." It was remarkable, and again the question is why. The answer is complicated. It has often been said that Lincoln was not religious, but there seems to be little doubt that as the war progressed, he became deeply moved by faith. In watching Lincoln evolve, one leaves with the sense that he came to feel that he had somehow been placed on this earth, elected as president, in the eye of this terrible war, for God's own designs. "There is a divinity that shapes our ends," he told one congressman in 1862. "The will of God prevails," he later declared. and perhaps most crucially, he increasingly saw himself as an instrument of providence, saying, "I am satisfied that when the Almighty wants me to do or not do a particular thing, he finds a way of letting me know it." Amid the scourge of conflict, this provided some of the lubricant for presidential leadership. In waiting for providential guidance at the critical points of the war, for perhaps the first time in his life, he felt not the familiar drumbeat of ambition or of political satisfaction, but of destiny. And when that happened, he was a rock. And if destiny meant preserving the Union, it also could not shield him forever from slavery. "If slavery is not wrong," he wrote to a friend in Kentucky, "then nothing is wrong." Yet still he waffled. In 1862, where the radicals were calling for emancipation, he flirted with a fantastic scheme to colonize freed blacks abroad. The first iteration was to resettle blacks in the Chiriquí coal region of Central America. When that fizzled out, the Central Americans would have no part of it, he brazenly suggested to a delegation of blacks that they should lead the way and recruit enough volunteers to resettle in Liberia. This, too, quickly fizzled. Then he came up with another wild scheme, signing a contract with white promoters to resettle 5,000 Negro volunteers on Haiti's Isle of Vache. By May 1863, only 450 had signed up, and this scheme also collapsed. But by then, it scarcely mattered. In the summer of 1862, Lincoln had experienced a profound change of heart, impelled by a combination of politics and morality. With his generals still floundering, his policies under fierce criticism from the radicals, the once wavering Lincoln had finally determined to move toward emancipation. He now reached for a formula of his own. Swept up by a sense of high purpose, he would institute a bold war measure while at the same time he would cleanse the lingering sin of the Constitution. By July 22, his mind was made up. It was no longer a question of whether it would be done, but when. "We mustn't issue it until after a victory," Lincoln told his cabinet. That victory came at Antietam on September 17. 5 days later, Lincoln made the Emancipation Proclamation public. The initial reception was decidedly mixed. The Emancipation Proclamation troubled some of Lincoln's critics, then and now. Again came the charge. Lincoln was too timid. One even jibed that he had no anti-slavery instincts. Lincoln was too political. Lincoln was too conservative. The proclamation expressly omitted the loyal slave states from its terms. It contained no indictment of slavery, being based on military necessity. And it didn't free any slaves, declaring simply that all slaves would be free in the states and part of the states where the people were in rebellion. In short, where its effect could not reach. As the London Spectator mocked, "The principle is not that a human being cannot justly own another, but that he cannot own him unless he is loyal to the United States." Even Seward was critical, barking, "We show our sympathy with slavery by emancipating the slaves where we cannot reach them and holding them in bondage where we can set them free." In some respects, the Congress was not unfair when it remarked that the proclamation added little to what it had already done with the Confiscation Act. But in the final analysis, these criticisms missed their mark. The Emancipation Proclamation was the most revolutionary document in the country's history since the Declaration of Independence. It truly began the end of slavery in the North and the South. The psychological impact of the proclamation cannot be underestimated. Lincoln, in a masterful stroke, had become a personal emblem of freedom, and the Emancipation Proclamation was its parchment. As a war act, it was also a stunning measure, imbuing the Northern war effort with a larger moral purpose without overshooting its mark. And for approximately 180,000 blacks, mostly slaves, it was nothing short of a miracle. They would go on to serve valiantly in the Federal Army. To the extent that Lincoln's commitment to eradicating slavery was in doubt, his efforts to pass the second 13th Amendment, codifying the Emancipation Proclamation in the Constitution, put that forever to rest. The year before, in 1864, the amendment had been easily defeated. This time, in January 1865, he again faced an uphill battle. The Democratic Party remained firmly opposed to the measure, having lambasted it as unwise, impolitic, cruel, and unworthy of the support of civilized people. But for the amendment to pass, Lincoln needed Democrats, at least 19. Otherwise, the measure would go down in flames, 93-80. The outlook was not good. Interestingly, for a man who often could not control his own generals or his own cabinet, he was invariably at his best in the two-step of party politics. Behind the scenes, Lincoln became a splendid hybrid of the resourceful Paul and the voice of a collective conscience. In an unswerving blitzkrieg, he addressed his colleagues quietly, huddled with party chiefs, and met across party lines. And then he began in earnest, rolling up his sleeves, twisting arms, making hard deals, corralling wavering members, and using every measure at his disposal to finagle, garner, or otherwise ensure the necessary two-thirds vote in the House of Representatives. When the roll was finally called, 8 Democrats abstained and 16 went with him. The amendment had been carried by all but the slimmest of margins, 3 votes, but it was broad enough to end slavery for time immemorial. But whatever his zeal for ending slavery, there was his even greater zeal for the Union. On November 19, 1863, Lincoln had made a short speech, 272 words, at the dedication of a cemetery at Gettysburg. By many lights, this address was a masterful verbal coup, subtly reshaping the Constitution which permitted slavery by squaring it with the Declaration of Independence, which was dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. In Gary Wills' phrase, the address corrected the Constitution without overthrowing it. Making relatively little impact at the time, the words now echo through history and the generations. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who gave their lives that that nation might live. This nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. But something deeper was taking place in this speech. At stake in this war, Lincoln was contending, was the struggle for the very survival of the nation. Not once in the speech did he refer to his cherished Union. Instead, 5 times he referred to the nation. This was no oversight. As a lawyer and careful student of the English language, Lincoln well understood the distinction between Union and nation. Not the greatest orator of his day, he nonetheless had a searing, resonant style, sparkling with 19th-century phrases and the soothing rhythmic cadence of classical speech. It is impossible to imagine Lincoln employing a ghostwriter. As Gary Wills has suggested, no one but Lincoln could write Lincolnian prose. The stamp of this man is on everything he uttered. When short, simple words hit hard, he used them. When soaring, rolling, pealing prose served his purpose, then he used it. And his feeling for the English word or turn of phrase was careful, rhythmic, even sensual, and so precise. Thus, we are inexorably drawn back to his use of union and nation. The first was a legal construct of a country. The second referred to the collective and shared identity of a people. Ideally, the two were intertwined, although in the case of Civil War America, they were most certainly not. Clearly, even in those dark days, some 2.5 years before April 1865, Lincoln was looking ahead to a time when they would be again. But looking ahead was one thing, getting there was another. By the end of the war, Lincoln had become a changed man, and most certainly a changed president. Once, back on the stump, politics had been invigorating sport. Now, operating from his presidential cocoon, he could no longer escape the judgment of his country. or of history? Was he playing to history, or even conscious of its mighty weight? The record suggests he did not overly dwell on his own legacy, but he was deeply conscious of it for the country. Unlike the whole of the rest of his life, his every decision, large and small, now carried grave import, affecting the lives of his soldiers, affecting the outcome of the battles, affecting the outcome of war, affecting the prospects for reconciliation, affecting the life or death of the nation. Presidents may do many things, but they do not have the luxury of complaining, or blaming others, or eluding responsibility, no matter how terrifying it is in all its dimensions. Second-rate presidents may act great during routine times when it is easy to do so. But it is only the truly great ones who act great during the difficult times. And where the second-rate presidents are somehow always shaped and prodded and manipulated by the forces of history, great ones find ways to bend those forces of history to their goals. Thus it was for Lincoln. He instinctively understood the moral burdens he had to shoulder. He appreciated the high seriousness of the crisis. He grasped its tragic proportions while never losing sight of the good that could somehow be made out of this awful conflict. And he did all this with a humane detachment that even now, history has trouble fully sorting out or explaining. As the Civil War entered its waning months, Lincoln was nevertheless an overwhelmingly melancholy man. Like many great generals who have had to send tens upon tens of thousands to their deaths, he had a corner of remorse lodged deep in his gut, furiously eating away at him. But there was something else, too, which almost seemed to defy explanation. His curious, almost indifferent attitude toward his own death. When he heard rumors of Confederate plots to kidnap or assassinate him, he persistently dismissed them. Even if true, I do not see what the rebels would gain. In August 1862, while he was riding his horse to the soldier's home, a gunshot rang out and a bullet whistled close by. Lincoln laughed it off, calling the incident ludicrous, farcical, and an accident. After his re-election in 1864, he began to receive hate mail with frequent regularity, including letters threatening his life. He coolly filed them himself in an envelope marked Assassination. "I know I'm in danger," he once confessed to Seward, "but I am not going to worry about it." So Lincoln walked alone at night, went off to the theater without guards, and repeatedly dismissed the charges made by his security men and Stanton that his life was in danger. "What does anyone want to assassinate me for?" he told Seward. And in Seward's words, "Assassination is not an American practice or habit." Lincoln agreed. "As to crazy folks, I must take my chances," he said. "I long ago made up my mind that if anybody wants to kill me, he will do it. There are a thousand ways of getting at a man if it is desired that he should be killed." When Stanton finally provided firm measures for 4 personal bodyguards, as well as a military escort, at least one of whom was to be with Lincoln at any given time, the president snapped back, "It is important that the people know I come among them without fear." But by April 14, as Lincoln readied himself to go to Ford's Theater, the stage was indeed set. Lincoln had been warned several times that this evening would be a particularly dangerous one, yet he refused to bow out or to take along an extra guard. To some, these are the convictions of a man without hate or malice, or the signs of a cavalier sort of recklessness, or of a morbid bit of bravado, or evidence of yet another troubling blind spot, or even of a man who has willingly acceded his control to the larger flow of events. Perhaps all this is true. But with hindsight, we can perhaps see things somewhat differently. They are the actions not of a passive man, but of a man hurtling toward his destiny, without fear or hesitation. And in the end, that destiny, that one issue which most compelled Lincoln, was Union, and the nation. He will always be remembered as freedom's champion when it was called into question, but he must also be judged as the nation's champion in its darkest hour. In no small measure, it explains why he refused to quit, or to compromise, or to take the easy political way out when it presented itself to him. In no small measure, it explains his relentless embrace of total war, and then, even as that war was ticking to a close, it explained his anxieties about unbridled chaos until the very end. And in no small measure, it accounted for his remarkable compassion and charity toward the Confederates that was to be the backbone of his post-war policy, and toward which he would now devote all his energies. All this he felt, and felt most passionately. But then came the bullet that bore into his brain. "Stop that man! Stop that man!" Clara Harris pleaded at Ford's Theater. But so quickly had it all happened that the images were almost impossible to digest, the reality of the events even less so. Once John Wilkes Booth, clad in his black felt hat and high boots with spurs, fired that single shot from his Derringer, Lincoln's companion, Major Rathbone, sought to wrestle him to the ground. Booth slashed his arm to the bone with a 7-inch dagger and leaped from the box, a difficult 2-story jump. Catching a spur and a flag, he crashed onto the stage and broke his left shin bone just above the ankle. There, he delivered his final line, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always to tyrants, the Virginia State motto, and then he hobbled to the backstage door, mounted his mare, and galloped off in the night. Amid the rush for the exits and shoving in the aisles, the theater was in an uproar. There were wild shrieks from Mary Lincoln. "Help! Help! Help!" There was the call for aid from Clara Harris. "Won't somebody stop that man?" There was the plea to stay calm from Laura Keene. "For God's sake, keep your places and all will be well." There was the rush to assist. "Has anyone any stimulants?" And there was the inevitable, shouted by an unknown member of the audience, "Is there a doctor in the house?" Mary was holding Lincoln in the rocker and sobbing madly when Charles A. Leal, a young army surgeon just 2 months out of medical school, finally managed to battle his way to the state box. With his eyes closed, Lincoln's head drooped forward to his breast. It immediately looked bad. Leal quickly spread Lincoln on the floor, and, cradling his head, could watch the blood slip through his fingers from where the projectile had entered. He could immediately see that Lincoln's breath was shallow, getting weaker by the second. Worst still, his wrist was without a pulse, and he was paralyzed. The bullet had burrowed deep into Lincoln's brain and fixed itself just behind his right eye. Working furiously, Leal dislodged a mass of clotting blood. Then he reached into Lincoln's mouth and, drawing in his own hard breath, began artificial respiration in a desperate attempt to revive the president. Another doctor arrived, and Leal commanded him to raise and lower the president's arms while Leal himself kneaded the left breast with both hands and then again started with the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Finally, Lincoln was breathing on his own, his breath irregular, his heart beating feebly. But Leal felt this was only temporary and sadly pronounced, "His wound is mortal. It is impossible for him to recover." Still, in medicine, as in politics, nothing is ever certain. After some quick deliberation, Leal, joined by 2 other doctors now, decided not to take him to the White House. It was deemed too far away, but to William Peterson's house across the street, where they would seek to work a miracle. An officer hastily drew his sword to cut a path through the throng anxiously assembled in 10th Street, and they carried him out into the dark, into the road, and up the curving steps of a modest row house, then along a thin hallway to the back, to the dingy little rented room of a War Department clerk. There, they lay the oversized president diagonally across a seedy Victorian 4-poster bed. A hissing gas lamp was lit, emitting a ghastly green light. Thus began the night of April 14 and 15. When Mary entered, she fell to her knees, weeping feverishly. Alternately, she whispered pet names and pleaded with him to speak. "One word," she implored, anything. But there was only the even, steady sound of his breath, up and down, up and down. By 11 p.m., the Lincoln's family doctor, Robert Kingstone, arrived, and he became the physician in charge, assisted by Joseph K. Barnes, the Surgeon General of the United States. They immediately sized up the situation as dreadful. Lincoln's right eye was badly swollen and discolored, and despite an army blanket and a colored wool coverlet, his extremities were growing very cold. His pulse was 45 and growing weaker. The doctors all agreed that Lincoln would not survive. They felt the average man would not last more than 2 hours. But they would try everything. Hot water bottles, mustard plasters, blankets, anything to keep him warm and keep his weakened heart beating. In turn, two doctors took it upon themselves to make an extensive record, charting his pulse and respiration. Press bulletins, updating the president's condition, were dispatched every half hour and quickly coursed over the web of telegraph wires in the north. When son Robert Lincoln finally arrived, he could see that grief and exhaustion were taking a toll on his mother, and Mary was soon persuaded to retire to the front parlor, where she again broke into convulsive sobbing. The time was 2 a.m. Now, on its own, Lincoln's body was desperately fighting death. It was not unimpressive. At 11:25, his pulse had dropped to 42. But by 12:32, it had climbed 18 beats to 60. At 12:45, it scaled another 10 beats, reaching 70. At 12:55, his arm suddenly began to twitch, making a struggling motion. At 1:30, the pulse had risen more than twofold. It stood at 95 and, as one doctor noted, appearing easier. While the night lengthened, a procession of government officials filed into the dim little room, and eventually the entire cabinet, except for Seward, crowded around, while the brigade of doctors continued to try everything at their disposal. All felt despair, disbelief, shock, and prayed for a miracle. When Lincoln's friend and political tormentor, Senator Sumner, came in, his face was paralyzed with grief. He gently fingered Lincoln's limp hand and began speaking to him, but one of the doctors interjected softly, "He can't hear you. He is dead." "No," a trembling Sumner hotly protested. "He isn't dead. Look at his face. He is breathing." As Lincoln lay there on the diagonal, his head propped up by extra pillows, his brain destroyed, his face swollen and discolored, and his blood seeping onto the bedspread and blanket, the doctors assured him that Lincoln would never again regain consciousness. Sumner lowered his head to Lincoln's, clutched his hand even more tightly, and lost all control. Recalled one observer, he wept like a woman. After 2 a.m., Lincoln's pulse again began to sink. At 3 a.m., Reverend Phineas Gurley said a prayer. In a hot press room some 200 miles to the north, the New York Times headlined its rush edition, "Awful Event. The President Still Alive at Last Counts. No Hopes Entertained of His Recovery." With the president dying and the government now at a virtual standstill, Secretary of War Stanton took charge. Blurry-eyed and nearly breaking down himself, he set up shop in the back parlor, where a federal judge and two other aides helped him take down testimony from witnesses. It was a frenzy of agitated activity. Soon, he realized that Washington was in the midst of a reign of terror. John Wilkes Booth was quickly identified as the president's assassin. Word also trickled in that another assassin had attempted to murder Seward, who, as it turned out, was still alive, but barely. His prognosis was uncertain, though it was thought that he would live. Meanwhile, Stanton feared for Grant's and Sherman's safety as well. He promptly ordered the city to be placed under martial law and dispatched an organized dragnet to hunt down Booth and all other suspects. By morning, accomplices Powell and Atzerodt would be under arrest, but Booth would have escaped. Throughout the night, Stanton became the government, issuing orders, taking testimony, assembling troops, and directing the massive manhunt underway. All major eastern ports were ordered to be on the lookout for suspicious persons. All traffic was stopped on the Potomac River and the railroads. All bridges and roads out of the capital were closed. Washington's fire brigade was mobilized to stand by for signs of mass arson. The front parlor now belonged to Mary Lincoln, who, collapsed upon a sofa, seesawed between dreadful spells of high-pitched wailing and disbelieving quiet. At one point, she recalled Lincoln's dream of a dead body in the White House and cried out in a terrible, fearful voice, "His dream was prophetic!" And she asked God to strike her down as well, to let her join her husband. Outside, in the fog and the mist, a crowd gathered, forming a protective sentinel in front of the Peterson house, all the while searching the leaders who came and went for the slightest indication that Lincoln would live. The minutes drifted by. Dr. Leal cradled the president's hand in his throughout, so that in the darkness he would know he had a friend. But Lincoln had more than one friend. In all, up to some 90 different people would make their way into the cramped room during the night. Almost hourly, Mary returned, entering the room, looking at her husband, looking at his engorged and swollen eye now turning purple, looking at the man who earlier in the day was so gay, so joyous, so happy, and cried out, "Oh, that my little Taddy might see his father before he died!" After some 7 hours had passed, Lincoln's ironically calm face suddenly began to twitch. This was too much for the depleted First Lady, shattering what residue of calm remained. She fell to the floor and screamed out in horror, prompting Stanton to holler, "Take that woman out and do not let her in again!" As the night wore on, Lincoln's respiration was increasingly accompanied by a low, guttural sound. Several times, it seemed as though he had ceased breathing altogether. Then his lungs would begin to swell again, each breath carrying with it a glimmer of hope. And throughout the room came the continued rise and fall of muffled weeping. Eventually, a heavy rain began to beat against the window panes as the first blush of gray dawn seeped through the windows. Lincoln was still alive, but not for much longer. Mary entered to see her husband one last time. Sumner was still there, now holding Lincoln's hand. Tears in her reddened eyes, she softly pressed her lips to his face and implored, "Love, live but one moment to speak to me once, to speak to our children." As his breathing grew fainter and fainter, she then moaned uncontrollably, "Oh my God, and have I given my husband to die?" Indeed she had. At 6 a.m., the doctor observed, pulse failing. At 6:25, he penned, choking and grunting. At 7 a.m., he added, symptoms of dissolution. Now, as the end neared, Lincoln's friends and colleagues huddled tearfully at his bedside. Lincoln's son Robert leaned his head on Sumner's shoulder and dissolved into unmitigated grief. Others, seeing that death was descending, also began to cry. Then the endless 9-hour struggle came to a close. The time was 7:22 a.m., April 15. With finality, the physician wrote, "Death." "It is all over," the doctors told Mary. "The president is no more." With this commenced a spontaneous ritual. A doctor laid silver $0.50 in Lincoln's eyelids. The Surgeon General slipped a sheet over his face, and the pastor of the New York Presbyterian Church mouthed a soothing prayer. Fighting back his own tears, Stanton, who had in effect become acting president, extended his right arm as in a salute, raised his hat and placed it for an instant on his head, and then in the same precise manner took it away. Gazing deeply at his fallen chief, he pronounced a private epitaph. "Now," he concluded, "he belongs to the angels." Moments later, his father left behind, lying on the bed, cool and still, Robert Lincoln led his mother by the hand out into the rain, into the muddy streets, into the uncertain future that Abraham Lincoln had so desperately sought to control. The world now knows well the power and peril of a single gunshot. Europe itself, witness to 500 years of assassinations and attempted assassinations. Even Napoleon was almost killed one Christmas Eve by a homemade bomb, would be reminded of its deadly fruits again in June 1914, when a young revolutionary would assassinate the Archduke Francis Ferdinand in the streets of Sarajevo, triggering a chain of events that within little over a month would culminate in a devastating world war. Yet for America, this was a first. Never before had a president been assassinated. Never before had a president died while a war was underway. Never before had an attempt been made to decapitate the very seat of government. All of which raised a host of fateful questions. How would the presidential transition process work in a crisis? Would the Confederate armies still in the field, spent though they might be, seek to take advantage of the chaos gripping Washington? And would Lincoln's legacy of healing devolve into nothing more than an orgy of retribution? And as sorrow gripped the Union, there remained one more haunting question. Would it now all come undone? Chapter 6. Would it all come undone? In retrospect, the air of foreboding about the hours and days that followed in mid-April has dimmed, replaced by the convenient sense that everyone of consequence played his part perfectly, like a well-rehearsed melody. The Constitution did its part. The new president and his cabinet did their part. The people did their part. And, rounded out by the towering might of the Union armies, all tumbled neatly and inevitably into place. But this is, of course, refracted nostalgia and conventional hindsight. Nothing, in fact, could be further from the truth. What really happened? It was a night of horrors. So wrote Chief Justice Salmon Chase. And so were the days that followed. As morning broke through the darkened skies on April 15, the North was stunned beyond belief. Lincoln dead? Seward attacked? Johnson a target? A possibly far-reaching Southern plot? But all this was merely a melancholy prelude, for then came the hardest part, sorting it all out. If one were to choose a time when the institutions of American democracy faced perhaps their greatest test, when the country sat at a defining crossroads, ready to veer in one direction, but just as able to choose another, it would not necessarily be the signing of the Declaration of Independence, or the historic closing of the Constitutional Convention, or the Union election of 1864, or even the fateful meeting at Appomattox. It would be this: the 9 long hours preceding 7:22 a.m. on April 15, and the 3 hours hence, until 10 a.m., about 12 hours all told, when the transfer of presidential power was set to take place, and the chaotic, rough, tumultuous days that followed in its uncertain wake. By 7:30 a.m., a strange light already began to fall and grow upon the Union. Vengeance and sorrow and chaos and turmoil threatened not the South, but the North. What could have been more incongruous? This was, after all, just 5 days after the giddy glow of Appomattox. But as a long wooden coffin was quietly edged down the narrow lodging house steps on 10th Street, through the mud and onto the roads, carrying Abraham Lincoln's body back to the White House, flags drooped to half-mast everywhere, and the muffled ringing of bells could be heard against the rain. Now it was the voices of revenge that could be heard loudest. Citizens poured into the streets, in the downpour, and soon they were nothing more than muttering mobs, a hostile throng angrily congregating from K Street to Lafayette Square. They shook their fists at Ford's Theater, shouting, "Burn the theater!" A cascade of ugly roars and boos spontaneously swelled up, fell, then continued even more loudly. Any mention of Confederates brought an equally vociferous reprise. "Shoot them! Hang them! Hang them again! Kill the goddamn rebels!" Talk of streets running red with Confederate blood was everywhere. And with the iron hand of martial law imposed upon the Union capital, the city remained edged with fear. In every direction, a phalanx of armed guards sought to keep order, manning stations on all roads to and from the city. Government departments and business houses were abruptly closed. The city was immediately cordoned off. Routine market wagons, milk carts, and mail riders were turned around and sent back beyond the outskirts. Theaters and music halls hastily canceled their engagements, and concerts and social functions were postponed indefinitely. But if the streets threatened to turn crimson with vengeance, they were just as quickly tinged with the real color of sorrow. Black was ubiquitous. So too were the telltale sounds of mourning. The White House columns were draped in black, and somber black folds were looped along all the federal buildings. The melancholy sound of organs